Welcome to Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today are Taha Lokhandwala, Deputy Personal Finance Editor at Investors Chronicle, and Ian Barnes, Head of Portfolio Management at NetWealth. If you're self-employed and don't have a workplace pension scheme or want to build up retirement money over and above your workplace scheme, one of the vehicles into which you can save for retirement tax efficiently is a self-directed personal pension, or SIP for short. As the name implies, with this kind of pension, it is you who is responsible for ensuring it delivers enough retirement income, which is not necessarily an easy task. One of the ways to try and ensure that your SIP does deliver the income you need in retirement is to follow the right investment strategy as you approach retirement. Taha, you've been looking at this. Why is this stage in the accumulation of retirement funds so important?
So it's all about transition. So you're coming to the end of the kind of growth stage where your only objective is to make sure you grow as capital as quickly and as in a risk-adjusted way as possible. And you're starting to think about the next stage. And so this is it's a period of transition because no decision should ever be a cliff edge. And you have to get this right because you can make mistakes in the growth stage. You can buy a duff stock. You can be in emerging markets for the wrong time. But the reason why that growth stage is so good is because you have enough time to kind of amend for those mistakes. The problem with this kind of pre-retirement transition period is you have to get it right, because if you make a mistake, you really don't have enough time for corrections. And then you'll be entering retirement either taking too much risk, taking too little risk, having suffered capital erosion when you really shouldn't have or didn't want to.
Why do SIPs require different asset allocations at this point?
Because you can do different things with a SIP, and this is the one of the beauties of the product. It's very flexible in terms of what you can do as you enter retirement. You want to be adjusting your asset allocation for the kind of retirement income or whatever you want to do with your SIP. So you need to align your assets with the eventual outcome. Income drawdown needs different asset allocation to an annuity, and you know if you're shifting, you're basically shifting from full-blown growth to kind of balanced risk and very outcome focused, I suppose the technical terms. You're looking at what you want to do with the assets at the end rather than just letting it grow.
Okay, now what key decisions do you need to make if you're going to go into income drawdown?
Income drawdown has a variety of options. It all depends what you're going to do with income drawdown. Firstly, understanding what income drawdown is quite important. It's basically where you leave your assets invested in markets, so you have a proportion of equities and bonds and kind of alternative assets.
Instead of buying an annuity.
Yeah, instead of buying an annuity, you remain invested, and then you take the investment growth and you either convert that into income or you leave it to grow or whatever. You can do it in different ways. You can take the natural yield, which is just taking the income produced from your investments. You can take a combination of your natural yield and some capital growth, which is kind of eating away at the growth. Or you can run down the value of your portfolio, which means you take as much as you want out. And if you're not worried about the kind of what you've got left in your pension running out of money before you die or before you want to do something else with it, you can just use as much money as you want. So the main thing you have to decide is what you're going to do. You also have to decide whether you're going to be using your SIP for your tax-free cash entitlement. So every person that enters retirement is allowed to take 25% of their entire pension wealth tax-free. Some people use their SIP for that. You can use it from your workplace pension or defined benefit pension if you have that. If you're going to use it from your SIP, then you have to account for that. And all these different options that I talked about all have different kind of risk profiles. So they need different allocations to mainly equities, because that's what's going to be the biggest driver of how much risk you're taking in your portfolio. So you need, if you're going to be taking kind of natural yield and capital growth, you need a combination of income growth and ballast, because you also want to make sure that your portfolio doesn't suffer massive drawdowns as well.
Okay, and could you give us maybe some examples of the kind of asset allocations you might have?
Sure. So if you just want to take the natural yield, which is one of the options I just mentioned, then you want to have your portfolio kind of invested in high yielding assets, which kind of makes sense. But it also means that you want some growth because you want your portfolio to grow at the same time. Or if you are just happy taking natural yield and are happy with the size of your portfolio, you can invest in high yield and then kind of use the rest of your portfolio for defense, so you maintain portfolio amount. If you want capital growth, where you use kind of natural yield and capital growth, you want balanced risks. There's no big drawdowns, but you also want to have a chunky portion of equities. If you're happy to erode, you can actually take less risk and have less growth but maintain value. So I'll give some examples. So Scottish Widows is a company I spoke to for this feature. They obviously are a massive pension provider in both SIPs and workplace, and they have kind of strategies for allowing people to enter retirement. So they shift from 85% equities to 30% equities in the build-up to retirement, and they class that as 15 years, but we'll come to that later. And then the rest in kind of bonds and cash, so that, you know, you've got 30% in risk assets, or the other ones in relatively safe assets, but also high yielding, and therefore gives you a kind of idea of what you'd be looking for.
Now, obviously, if you aren't going into income drawdown, I think as we mentioned before, you purchase an annuity. So what sort of asset allocation should you have if you plan to use your pension funds to purchase an annuity?
So this is quite interesting. So annuity, basically, it's a guarantee. It's an insurance contract which gives you guaranteed income for life. You hand over all of your assets to an insurance company and they just give you an annual income. So asset allocation here is important because it's really good to align your SIP with what the insurance provider kind of buys an annuity with. And the reason for that is that if you have done that prior to the purchase, you will get the best value annuity that you could possibly get. So what that is generally long-dated corporate bonds. So if you have your SIP, the amount of your SIP that you're going to be buying an annuity with, in all invested in long-dated bonds, the day before you buy an annuity, you will get the best possible value. What's important is the transition from equities to long-dated corporate bonds, though, because you need to be kind of selling out in a not a slow way, but a kind of uniformed way, and making sure that you kind of preserve as much capital growth as you can. Do not suffer any big drawdowns prior to you paying this annuity purchase, because as soon as you do that, you have no time to get that money back and you will just suffer with a lower income for the rest of retirement.
Okay, and so what kind of time should you do that? Because obviously you certainly don't want bonds in the early stage of the accumulation process, I presume.
No, absolutely not. So It's an interesting debate, and every person I spoke to in this feature in this week's magazine had a different idea of the time period. So Scottish Widows, who I mentioned earlier, they do it over 15 years. That's quite risk averse, and they do it over 15 years because, you know, they are stewards of other people's money. A SIP, and by definition, you're doing it yourself, so therefore you can take your own risk and decide how long you want to do it for. The general rule is to do it over a market cycle, because that means that you aren't suffering any big drawdowns just the kind of the immediate moment before you start making changes. So that's about 7.5 years. One person I spoke to said 3 years, which again you can do. And you can also do something where you take a limited view on markets. Like, for example, the person said, if you're doing this right now, you would probably look at the future expectations of markets and go, well, actually, I'm going to start taking risk off the table a lot quicker and a lot sooner than perhaps you would have done 2 years ago when markets were looking a bit better.
Ian, what would you say are the key things to consider when putting together a portfolio for long-term growth like a pension?
Hi. Well, I guess the most important thing to us is really to focus on the time frame that you're looking at. So, you know, a pension structure is the ultimate sort of long-lived structure to invest within, and you can really take advantage of that. So, say if you're in your early 40s, you know, you could probably expect to be in the accumulation phase for another 20, 25 years, and then hopefully another 20 or so years in the decumulation phase. That's a really long period of time over which, you know, you can be investing. And one of the key risks, we think, is that people take a little too little risk in their portfolio. So people think of pensions, they think of security, and actually you're by reducing the amount of risk that you take in a portfolio in the early years, you're actually putting at risk the chances of achieving your investment objectives, because you've got so much time that you can, well, you know, you can afford to take on a bit more, you know, market volatility, because you've got time to recover from that. So we think that's one of the most important things, is to understand the volatility you can withstand.
Okay. And what kind of assets should investors starting a SIP consider investing in?
Yeah, well, so as Tara mentioned, you know, you've got this opportunity for building up a pot of assets that you can draw down later. So you want to be focused more on assets with exposure to growth. You know, obviously equity markets are a key component of that, and you can diversify within the types of equity assets that you take exposure to. I mean, it is possible to incorporate less liquid assets. So we sometimes, you know, find people who've taken exposure to commercial real estate. we think that, you know, sometimes you still need to be careful about your liquidity profile if you do, if your circumstances do change, say your expectations of how much you'll need to rely on this particular pot, say in the future, or even from regulatory change. So we tend to keep all of our assets growth oriented, but very liquid at the same time.
Okay. And can I ask what kind of equities would you consider? Because obviously there's very different types of equities. So say you start a SIP, it's 30 years or something to retirement, you know, what kind of equities would be good?
Well, I think you need to build a decent picture of your overall portfolio exposure. So we tend to diversify on account of region, on account of currency, sectoral exposures as well, and then different style of investment fund as well. But the most important criteria for us is thinking about, you know, the cost of investing in these particular assets. So for us, it's always making sure that whatever you're choosing to do, whatever the right portfolio mix is, it's doing it as efficiently as possible.
As time progresses, how would you change this allocation as retirement comes nearer?
Yeah, so, you know, I think it depends on a particular client's circumstances and how much they're going to rely on a particular pot of money. So as Tyler's mentioned, if you're approaching a point of retirement and this is going to be your sole source of income, then that's a very different question to some people who invest in SIPs where it's going to be a component of their future flows. Because, you know, ultimately, if you reach retirement age at 65, you may still have a long period of investment still to go. And for wealthier individuals, they may think of a SIP as being a pot of money that they don't actually intend to draw down. It's just going to be something that they can pass on, through their wills on a tax-free basis on their death. So for them, remaining in very growth-oriented asset classes will be appropriate. I mean, historically, people used to talk about investing, the amount of in fixed income of your age. So if your portfolio is a 40-year-old, you want to have 40% in fixed income. We think that that's really risk being too conservative because of the increased longevity that most people will encounter. But it certainly makes a sense to, as you're approaching retirement, as you're coming to a step change in your circumstances, maybe to take a one-off piece of advice so people can help reassess what they want to, how they want to be positioned.
Yeah, and I guess as Tom mentioned earlier, a lot comes down to whether you're going to buy annuities or whether you're going to go into income drawdown, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay. Now, thinking again about the accumulation phase, what would you say some key mistakes investors should try to avoid making?
Yeah, so again, we think this comes down to the importance of your time frame. So the one advantage that we as investors in the accumulation phase have is time, and you want to be making sure that you're using that time frame to compound the returns as strongly as possible, certainly on a risk adjusted basis, but accept the market risk that you can take and be able to compound returns year on year. And the best way to make sure that you're compounding returns efficiently is to make sure that your costs are in line. So one of the biggest drivers of investment performance is how much costs are eating into your returns. And we did a study where if you're thinking about reducing your costs, say, by 1% over a time frame of 10 years, if you assume normal market returns of, say, 5% or so on a gross basis, if you reduce your cost by 1%, then that can actually add on 12% of your original capital onto your overall returns. And going from 10 years to 20 years, then that 1% reduction in costs or fees or however you think about it can return up to 40% of your original working capital, which can have a massive impact on your overall outcome and what you can actually do in retirement. And the other thing that we think is important is just try not to time the market. Because when you are in there, use the compounding to your advantage. You've got time to bear market risk. And if you're trying to time the market, we always think that it's particularly difficult because you've got to get the decision right twice. You've got to know when to sell. And then it's all too easy because there's always going to be visible risks out there to say, actually, I'm comfortable just sitting on the sidelines. and then you forget to reinvest, or the time never seems like the right point in time. So we always think, you know, control what you can, stay invested, and use time to your advantage.
Yeah. Just out of interest, what would be your suggestions on keeping investment costs down? I mean, I know a lot of people think, oh, just use passive funds. Is it just a case of using passive funds? Or, you know, how would you suggest keeping investment costs low?
Well, so there can be different ways. I think, yeah, we invest predominantly on a passive basis. Mm-hmm. And that's not, you know, from a religious or a philosophical mm-hmm. point of view. Mm-hmm. It's very much evidence-based that you know, those charges that active managers, you know, tend to charge are very hard to overcome through time. It's very hard to anticipate which manager is going to be able to deliver those excess returns. But otherwise, you know, make sure that you're stripping out the layers of cost that you don't need. So a lot of people will pay for ongoing advice, which we feel is not necessarily appropriate. Most people's financial situations are not that complicated. So pay for advice when you need it on a one-off basis. But otherwise, just keep your, you know, just stick to pure management costs.
After retirement, if you opt for income drawdown, as we discussed above, what kind of asset allocations might be suitable? And I appreciate there are obviously many different variations, but just generally.
Yeah. So, you know, I think historically people have had a very strong focus on income generating assets. You know, particularly within the UK, there's a very strong yield culture where people are looking for yield generating assets with a bit of security. And that intensified after the financial crisis, where, you know, the yields available on fixed income instruments weren't deemed as attractive. So we think a big risk is that you have a concentration on an income style, because too much money chasing, you know, this holy grail of secure yield just inherently changes the characteristics of the type of securities you're looking at. So for some people, an income bias might be appropriate. Another way to do it is, you know, you can use technology to try and take into account the nuances of your particular cash flow requirements and stick more to a total return focus. So get your overall tolerance for risk and for market losses right, and then just be aware that you can draw down on capital as well as take the natural income that's generated from the underlying securities.
Okay.
So that's what we tend to do.
Yeah, I would add that if you do that within a SIP or an ISA, then you don't incur capital gains tax when you sell your profits, do you?
No, like, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's no, you don't necessarily need to just focus on the income characteristics. Think about the gains you can get from capital.
As long as it's in a tax efficient environment.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Ian. Some really helpful points. And see the SIP supplement with this week's Investors Chronicle for more suitable asset allocations, how to manage risk, mistakes to avoid, and good funds for your SIP. When you're investing, you hopefully put a lot of effort into trying to select the right investments for your goals. However, stocks, sectors, and even regions go in and out of fashion, meaning that market factors and investment styles may be more likely to determine returns. Taha, first of all, what actually are market factors and investment styles?
So yeah, it's quite interesting. As you say, it's the things that aside from like regions and sectors and stuff like that. And I suppose factors best described as the underlying reasons why markets rise and fall, aside from like the fundamentals of stocks. So these are the collective kind of reasons why markets go one way or the other. And a style is just a different way of buying investments. So when we talk about style, our listeners are probably most used to thinking about things like value and growth, whereas market factors are things like low volatility and momentum. So momentum is the basic concept that whatever's been rising most recently is probably more likely to continue rising in the short term future. And if you can align your portfolio to take advantage of those kind of factors, then, you know, over the long term, you will outperform the market average.
Okay, so how have these factors done, let's say, over the past decade?
It's interesting. So if you look at each of the last 10 years in its own calendar basis, so if you look at, you know, 2012 versus 2013 versus 2014, it changes quite rapidly as to which style has worked in what year, which is unusual because generally, when we think about the last 10 years, everyone will just say, well, growth has been outperforming. Yes, on a cumulative basis, growth have been. In each individual year, there was those times when it was minimum volatility, times when it was growth, times when it was momentum, and in 2016, times when it was value. So it's kind of interesting to see how the actual underlying reasons why markets are rising changes year on year, but on a wider scale, it looks as if one thing has dominated.
I suppose the big question is, that's the past, so how do you know which ones to tilt to going ahead?
Obviously, past performance never is a guide, as we know. What is good to look at is what you, by looking at these 10 years, as I mentioned, is you can understand why one factor or style outperforms another in one year or one period, and why. And there are lots of reasons. You know, growth works best in times of low economic growth, which is kind of counterintuitive, but also true. Value works best in times of good economic growth. Low volatility and quality have defensive characteristics. So when things are looking a bit hairy, or if there's volatility in the market, low volatility stocks tend to outperform. So what does that mean going forward? Well, firstly, as with everything, you never back one style or factor in its entirety. You should always keep a blend. These styles and factors are known as risk premium. So if you hold them all in the long term, they will outperform the market average. So if you hold a blend of them in the long term, you should also then outperform the market average, and in a kind of diversified and risk adjusted way. That being said, there's always times to tell, you know, what kind of professional investors are leaning towards. So as I said, minimum volatility and quality for defense. If you're worried about the outlook for markets, that could be sensible. A lot of people backing value, which I say they have been for many, many, many years. But value still remains cheap as a style. So you could do that as well.
How would you go about tilting your portfolio to them?
So factors, because they're kind of mathematical reasons why markets are performing, they're best kind of, well, I suppose not best, one of the easiest ways to get exposure to them is via algorithms, which are best formed in ETFs. So iShares, and other ETF providers do this as well, but one of the finest ranges is the iShares Edge Range, which can give you access to most of the factors that I mentioned across different regions on a global basis and stuff like that. There's more details in the magazine on the ones that I've chosen. There's also another one that was highlighted to me, which is the UBS FTSE RAFI Developed Index Fund. And this is quite an interesting one because it uses an algorithm that then weights according to valuation metrics. So it, rather than kind of allocating the most to the largest stock, it allocates the most to stocks with the better price to book ratios, dividend yields, and it kind of constantly adjusts on a quarterly basis. So what it should be doing really is selling high and buying low, which we all know is the best way to increase your returns.
Ian, how important do you think market factors and investment styles are in determining returns?
I think it depends how narrowly you define the factors and different sort of risk premia. You know, I think historically investors paid a lot of attention to the implicit drivers of asset class returns or stock returns. So they maybe didn't define them quite as factors, but you know, you knew that something's exposure to a particular risk premium was going to be a driver of returns at different times. Taking that further onto factors, we think it's a question of whether or not you can isolate a particular factor exposure beyond all of the other things that might be going on in affecting a particular company's return. So by trying to target one exposure, you might unknowingly be exposing yourself to a bunch of other things. I mean, we just think that the most important broad factor exposure is really getting your market exposure right. That's always going to be the most important driver, and then the nuances within that are going to be somewhat less important.
Okay, so I suppose how much consideration should you give these market factors and styles then?
Well, I think it's important. If you think that they're going to be helpful to diversification, then that's great. I mean, you know, you can talk about the say the momentum factor, and in isolation, that's been proven to be to add value through time. So exposing yourself to something with earnings momentum and price momentum can be a good thing. It tends to increase the volatility of returns quite a lot, and you might find that it's working poorest at a point when the rest of your portfolio is also coming under pressure as well. So it sort of amplifies your exposure to market and risk at times. And so that's something that we think is slightly difficult. The other thing is just a question of, you know, liquidity. So some factors work better in environments where liquidity is plentiful, and others perform better when you're finding that, you know, liquidity is less available. And, you know, making sure that you're balancing that with other moving parts within a portfolio is pretty important.
Okay, so with that in mind, what are the risks of having biases to factors and styles?
So, we will start with a sort of naive benchmark as the starting point. So, a traditional sort of market cap index. Any movement away from that, you could be thinking about, you know, is a risk. But most investment risk can be put down to not understanding the assets that you're invested in, poor timing, or not judging your capacity for loss appropriately. So sort of selling an asset when you don't want to. But so in investing in any of these factor products can sort of build on some of those risks. So, you know, different styles of value products work well at different times. So you might find yourself in a particular product, if you don't really understand how it's being built, then it might not work for you. And the financial industry has always been very, very good at building demand for a product that they have to sell. And so we tend to be relatively cynical about some of the factor based strategies that are now available or smart beta. So we just think that understanding what is actually going on in an instrument is probably the most important risk.
So do you think these funds are worth any consideration at all? Or?
No, we do. So we think, you know, if there's a particular risk within a naive benchmark, so say take US equities, where they've got a large allocation to the technology sector, which has been performing extremely well, people start to worry about how efficiently the market's sort of pricing some of the risks that are inherent in that sector. So if you think you want to be invested in US equities, but can be aware that, you know, one particular sector is completely driving all of your returns and you want to step away from that, then one of these strategies that specifically target other characteristics can be very helpful. I think we probably haven't seen in a long enough period of time that some of the newer factor-based strategies have been working to understand how they work through the cycle, because quite often these approaches work well in their development phase, and then once the products are launched, and, you know, it doesn't necessarily seem to work in quite the way as intended. But we think they can be helpful, and we do in fact own one of them in our portfolios.
Okay, which one is that?
Well, so to step away from the bias of the tech sector, we did look at the value strategy from iShares.
Okay, interesting. Now, you mentioned that ultimately factors and investors, they aren't the most important things in portfolio construction. So just, I suppose, just generally and briefly, you know, what are the key important things to think about when constructing an investment portfolio?
So for us, it comes back down to efficiency, that you've just got to make the things that you can control. One of them is costs. Make sure that you're not, giving yourself too high a hurdle for your decisions to overcome in terms of the costs. The other thing is, whatever your approach is, just try and make sure that it's as disciplined as possible. You know, it's all too easy to read about the different challenges that the market environment is facing, but try and stay disciplined to your investment approach. And overarching that, I get all sort of built into that, is just this idea of avoiding, you know, false narratives. Like, the investment world has been very, very worried about the prospect of inflation and what that could do to bond returns for nearly a decade now. And yet, you know, US equities have outperformed commodities, which you might think would be sensitive to inflation risk, by an extraordinary amount over that period. And, you know, gilt yields, 10-year gilt yields, are still knocking on 1%. So, you know, just don't get tempted to read too much into some of the narratives that might be, you know, trendy at a particular point in time.
Thank you, Ian. Some really helpful points. If you're thinking of investing in a fund, you probably want to know, among many other things, what its strategy is and how it's performed against its peers and relevant benchmarks. But believe it or not, getting this information is not necessarily straightforward. Taha, why can it be so difficult to get this really basic information?
Well, it just isn't there, and it's inexplicable as to why. You look at fund marketing documents, and it's just full of poor descriptions, misleading benchmarks, inconsistent benchmarks, which is the worst thing. So, you know, we had examples before about absolute return funds that say they're going to beat LIBOR plus 3, but then you look at their fact sheets and they just put LIBOR on there, because obviously if you take away the 3, it's a lot better. And, you know, just how they're allowed to get away with that is bizarre. Fund descriptions, I highlighted one in this week's magazine. The aim of this fund is to provide long-term capital growth.
Bit vague, isn't it?
I mean, yeah. It's
isn't that what everything does?
It's why we invest. Absolutely useless. It's fascinating because, you know, this fund, I'm not going to name which one because it's not alone in its crime. You know, if they're underperforming the benchmark, they'll be straight onto the microphone looking at the nuances of their strategy as to why they've underperformed their benchmark for 3 years in a row. But when it comes to their own documentation, they can't be bothered to explain what those nuances are. And it's just a bit ridiculous. It's lazy. You know, it takes time and effort to realize what a fund actually does. I've been doing this for years and it still takes me a long time to realize what a manager is doing. And I have access to a lot of information that private investors don't. I suppose if you ask asset managers, they will blame regulation and they will say, you know, that it's too stringent about what they're supposed to put onto these fact sheets and kind of key investor documents and key investor information documents and things like that. But regulation is the minimum amount asset managers have to do. They can still go above and beyond that and actually help investors understand what they do, and they actively choose not to.
Okay, but this situation actually looks like it's going to improve. How?
So this is another part of the FCA, which is the Financial Conduct Authority, the Financial Services Regulator. They've been doing a study and an investigation into the asset management industry for 3.5 years now, I suppose. And this is another piece in that jigsaw. So they are going, well, they've said that asset managers and fund providers should now make sure that their objectives include relevant information about the investment strategy. And that could go as far as, you know, being explicit about saying whether a value manager or a growth manager, and explain how that's run. They should be concise. They should not use jargon. On the benchmark side, benchmarks that they choose have to be relevant and consistent. And consistent as in going back to the LIBOR point I made. So if they use a benchmark, they have to explain why and then use the same benchmark on all documents that they have about that fund. If they don't choose a benchmark, they have to explain why they haven't chosen a benchmark and provide a comparative tool and some kind of guidance so investors can judge performance of the fund. Also, I think this is probably one of the smaller bits, but the quite important bit. If there isn't a benchmark, but there is an implicit benchmark, as in if the fund manager's pay is linked to outperforming a benchmark, or if the risk profile of the fund is linked to a benchmark, they have to be clear about that. And therefore, they're calling that an implicit benchmark, which means that, you know, they have to declare that and then fund, investors can use that as well.
That sounds good. When do these rules come in?
So for newly launched funds within 3 months and for existing funds within 6 months. So we should see, you know, some changes this year.
Okay, so quite soon. So big question. They sound like good ideas. Will they actually make a difference?
I suppose it's wait and see. It's interesting to see how it will. So the FCA hasn't actually been massively prescriptive in how they're asking fund managers to do this. And some people think that's leaving the ball very much in the industry's court. And as I explained at the beginning of this section, when left to their own devices, they're not exactly brilliant about it. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, but these are new rules and these are new requirements, so there should be some changes. It's whether it's going to be enough, I suppose, is the big point. Because some of the comments in the consultation, they were kind of petty. You know, one company said that they didn't think the additional compliance work would be worth the benefit to investors. Quite frankly, they don't get to decide that. They don't get to decide what's good for consumers and what isn't. Consumers get to decide that. So there's a risk they don't take it in the spirit in which it's intended.
Thank you, Taha. And you can see his full report on how funds will have to improve their transparency in this week's Funds News. That brings us to the end of today's show, but see our special SIP supplement for more on how to generate a good retirement income and read more about market factors and investment styles in this week's Investors Chronicle on the website. Thank you for listening and have a good weekend.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.